anyone who tries to guess how well Ted Stevens or Mark Begich is going to do is just shooting in the dark.
The Division of Elections tallies more votes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 12th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, measuring an untapped Alaskan resource.
The natural gas hydrates have more energy potential than all fossil fuels combined.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, helping customers get to the next stage through banking, loans, and retirement planning. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich has taken a 3-vote lead over Senator Ted Stevens in the latest vote count, updated released this afternoon by the Division of Elections. More returns are possible this evening, APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The Division of Elections this afternoon released the results of votes from about 44,000 ballots, and those results show that Mark Begich covered a more than 3,200-vote shortfall, taking the slimmest of margins for the moment. The Division has planned to count another 10,000 votes today and tonight, and another 40,000 questioned and absentee ballots are still pending. In legislative campaigns, 6 House races and 1 Senate race came out of Election Day within margins that observers said could easily change with a new count. So far, there's been no change in who's leading the race. In Fairbanks, Democrat Joe Pascvan leads Cynthia Henry by 391 votes in their race for District E. In the House, Republican Mike Kelly holds on to his seat in a race with Carl Castle. Kelly's ahead by 32 votes. Incumbent Scott Kawasaki's leading by 280 votes over challenger Sue Hall. Throughout the rest of the state, Democrat Pete Peterson now has a 219-vote lead over incumbent Republican Bob Roses. Also, Democrat Chris Tuck is taking District 29 away from the Republicans, as he leads Ronald Jordan by 233 votes. Former Kodiak State Senator and Frank Murkowski staff member Alan Osterman has picked up a sizable 369-vote lead over Democrat Andrew Lundquist. And in the closest race on Election Day, Democrat Bob Book has increased his lead over Bob Lewis. He now has a 115-vote margin. More than 90,000 ballots were uncounted at the start of the day, and elections officials plan to work through a little more than half of them today and tonight. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
At the Anchorage Division of Elections office today, party observers, some campaign staff, and the occasional candidate watched through a large plate glass window as workers counted ballots in a separate room. Each time a House district was completed, a door opened and 2 tally ribbons were handed out, one for the Republicans and one for the Democrats. Immediately, the ribbons were scoured for that district's results.
District by district,
yeah.
This is at East Anchorage.
How painful that is.
What did we gain there?
District by
did you
district.
Do that math for me?
Yeah, it's...
Casey Reynolds spent today observing the vote count for the Republican Party. He was satisfied with the process.
We've been watching the vote counting, and I haven't heard any problems from either the Democrats or the Republicans, so I'd have to say it's going pretty smooth.
Reynolds was neither surprised nor alarmed as the vote tally began to shift, shrinking Don Young's lead over Ethan Berkowitz in the U.S. House race and giving Mark Begich the lead over Ted Stevens for U.S. Senate. He says today's count included a lot of early votes, which typically favor Democrats.
You could see that even in the early votes that were counted on before election night there, that Begich and Berkowitz did very well in that, and so we sort of expected that same percentage to hold for the remainder. I don't know the exact totals at this point, but it seems to approximately be the case, at least here in Anchorage, and so I would imagine it's true across the state. And then the question ballots and the absentees is really where we'll see the movement happen.
Democrat observer and Begich campaign volunteer David Finkelstein agreed that it was impossible to see an overall trend to the count. That was partially due, he said, because of differences between regional election headquarters.
Around the state, every region's counting differently. In Nome, there's no counting occurring, and in Juneau, they're counting potentially all of the different categories, absentees, early voting, and question. In Fairbanks, they appear to be counting the same as Anchorage, the early votes and absentees. the numbers come together at the end of the day. Right now, Mark Begich is doing well, catching up, but that doesn't mean those are going to be the final numbers.
If in several ways the November 4th election was historic for Alaska, Finkelstein says in one way, so is today's post-election tally.
For the first time, we're having counts of absentees when there's been none. Every other election held, there's always been absentee votes counted on election day. So when we, the public, see the result on election day, we're seeing a lot of the absentees. This year, the absentees have not been counted at all. Today's are the first counts, so anyone who tries to guess how well Ted Stevens or Mark Begich is going to do is just shooting in the dark.
Finkelstein himself is a veteran of a close election with a delayed decision. In 1988, he ran for the state house in a race that ended with a two-vote difference and an order by the U.S. Supreme Court requiring a new election. Finkelstein won in the subsequent special election. Another figure in Alaska's ongoing political corruption scandal is headed to prison. Former Alaska businessman Bill Wymer was sentenced to 6 months in prison, 6 months home confinement, and fined $75,000 in Anchorage federal court this morning. Wymer used to run profitable halfway houses for Alaska and is now retired and living in Montana. He pleaded guilty in August for his role in a scheme to funnel $20,000 to a state Senate candidate. Lisa Diemer has been covering the case for the Anchorage Daily News and was at the courthouse this morning. She says Wymer was sentenced for two felony convictions.
It's a conspiracy charge, and then the other one is kind of complicated, and it's called, quote, structuring financial transactions. And it has to do with dividing up the $20,000 that he sent to a political consultant into smaller payments so it wouldn't have to be reported to the U.S. Treasury.
So what happened at the sentencing hearing today?
Everyone spoke, his lawyer, the prosecutor, and Bill Wymer, as well as the judge, and they all had interesting things to say. There weren't very many people in the courtroom. It was a little bit surprising. It was at 8:30 in the morning, and there were just a couple of reporters, a couple of bloggers, not very many people at all.
And what about Judge John Sedgwick? What did he say when he sentenced Wymer?
He said, and I'll just give you his quote here, he said, quote, it was the kind of offense that does great damage to our community because it allows for the corruption of a public process that we all really depend upon. He said that, you know, that he was really surprised by all of these corruption cases happening here in Alaska. He's been the judge on almost all of them, and he said he never thought it would happen here.
Is 6 months what Wymer was hoping for?
About. He ended up with 6 months in prison and 6 months home confinement. Wymer's lawyer had proposed 5 months in prison and 5 months of community service in which he would be free to leave his home for other reasons as well. So it's a little bit more than that. The biggest surprise in the sentence, I think, was the fine. The prosecution had asked for $20,000. The defense said, well, $30,000. And the judge said $75,000. He said this is a man with substantial resources and he needed to make a point with a high fine.
In an article earlier this week, you mentioned that out of five people who have pled guilty in the ongoing corruption scandal, Wymer is the only one who hasn't signed a formal cooperation agreement with the government. Has he or his lawyers explained why?
His lawyer said it this way, that it was that he didn't want to have to wait for his case to be resolved until the cooperation, you know, was provided in every form. That's how these other agreements have gone. The former VICO executives, Bill Allen and Rick Smith, still haven't been sentenced, so it's all still hanging over them, and they know they've got to keep doing what the government asks until these cases are all wrapped up. The prosecutor, though, had a kind of a different take, and it was also one of the more interesting things said today in court, and this was Joe Bottini, assistant U.S. attorney, and he said, quote, referring to Wymer, while he did provide a substantial amount of information, the bottom line was it didn't advance the ball one inch for the government, and that's just the hard reality of it. End quote. So while he sat down and talked to the government, to investigators, it didn't really help them in their investigation.
Lisa Diemer is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a music program that could help save lives in Gambell.
Actually hits you in the heart, inside. Music makes me happy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
A former Prince William Sound fish processor, Seahawk Seafoods of Valdez, has been denied a request for a larger share of the money in the Exxon Valdez punitive damages award. Seahawk filed last month for a larger share of the $507 million. Federal Judge Russell Holland heard oral arguments last week in the case. In his decision, Judge Holland said, "The court has no doubt that Seahawk, like other plaintiffs, is disappointed that the reduction in the punitive damages award will result in a final distribution much smaller than was anticipated, but that disappointment does not somehow translate into a right to disturb that which Seahawk agreed to years ago." Seahawk's motion 71 to vacate the plan of allocation is denied, as is its request to withdraw from the 1995 joint prosecution agreement and or plan of allocation. The first round of checks could start being distributed next week. Alaska contains enough natural gas in the form of hydrates to heat more than 100 million homes for a decade. That's according to a report released today by the U.S. Geological Survey. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, accessing Alaska's natural gas hydrates is a long way off, but federal scientists say they now have a better understanding of their potential.
Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne says the new report released by the U.S. Geological Survey shows the potential for methane hydrates in Alaska.
Today we move the story of natural gas hydrates from the realm of science and speculation to the realm of the actual and the useful.
A natural gas hydrate is an ice-like solid. It's formed when water molecules trap gas molecules in a cage-like structure. The trapped gas is the same natural gas used to heat homes and produce electricity. Kempthorne's staff set up what looks like a high school science experiment to show the gathered reporters samples of hydrates. These aren't from Alaska's North Slope. Those would be worth more than gold because of all the effort it takes to extract them at this point. Instead, these were made in a lab. Small pieces come steaming out of a cold tank and are white, like a dense piece of snow. They crackle and pop. So I'm holding a piece in my hand and it's sizzling. It feels like ice. It's really cold. As it sputters and melts, it releases methane gas and water, which pools in my hand. Hydrates are created by the right combination of low temperature and high pressure. Kempthorne says they form under the seabed, but also under permafrost.
More than 90% of the natural gas hydrates in the United States are federally managed resources occurring on the North Slope of Alaska and on the Outer Continental Shelf.
And Kempthorne says the U.S. Geological Survey's assessment is the first to examine just how much methane in the form of hydrates could be tapped in Alaska. It estimates there are 84.5 trillion cubic feet on the North Slope.
The natural gas hydrates have more energy potential than all fossil fuels combined. So this is great information.
So what now? More research and study, and the continued press to build a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope. The director of the U.S. Geological Survey, Mark Myers, says without that, the gas is stuck.
Large-scale production will have to wait till there's a market. The gas can't be delivered to the market until there's a gas pipeline.
Myers says the new numbers about gas hydrates should add incentive to the motivation for developing a pipeline. But environmentalists have concerns. About 4% of the hydrates mentioned in the new study are in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Ethan Manuel with the Sierra Club fears the process of extracting hydrates could damage ecosystems.
Alaska's North Slope, especially the Arctic Refuge, is the wrong place to look for natural gas and the wrong place for us to look for solutions to our current energy challenges.
But the U.S. Geological Survey says gas from methane hydrates could be extracted with techniques already used at producing gas fields. However, the state's Division of Oil and Gas Director Kevin Banks says there are still questions about how exactly to extract Alaska's methane hydrates.
I'm focused mostly on just how it's to be produced. We don't know how hydrates flow and whether they will flow for a long time. There's been just a few wells that have been drilled to test those capabilities.
Banks says Alaskans have known for years that there's a healthy supply of methane hydrates on the North Slope because whenever a development well is drilled in fields like Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, they pass through the zone where the hydrates occur. Banks says they've often been regarded as a geohazard, something for drillers to be careful around, and there's always been the question and the hope that they could be economically recovered.
Hydrates aren't found in very many places in the world. If we could bring these to market, it would be a tremendous boon for Alaska, but also it would be a wonderful source of energy for the lower 48.
Officials with the U.S. Geological Survey say the next step is conducting long-term tests. They're being planned for 2009 through 2011. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A study shows coal-to-liquids technology could work for the interior. The feasibility study was commissioned by the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, or FEDCO, as a first step toward addressing the region's dependence on oil. At a press conference in Fairbanks yesterday, FEDCO CEO Jim Dodson said the study answers two basic questions about the proposed coal-to-liquids project.
Was the technology out there that was going to work in our environment? And the answer to that question was yes. And if we went ahead with this project, based on the cost of energy, is this project feasible? And also the answer to that question is yes.
Dodson says the report shows a coal-to-liquids plant could produce synthetic fuels for heating, transportation, and power generation that would sell in the low $2 a gallon range. He says the value of the plant, which could also convert biomass or natural gas into liquid fuels, transcends simply competing with crude.
We're taking low-valued resources and turning it into a high-valued product with Alaska labor. With interior labor. So we're not only creating energy for Alaska, but we're also hopefully creating jobs and new opportunities.
Dodson says the synthetic fuel project is one Fairbanks could control without having to deal with the major oil companies. The cost of building a plant is estimated at $4 to $7.5 billion, depending on size. Profit margins are low in the economic models considered, and a public-private partnership is envisioned to take on the endeavor. One likely partner is the U.S. Air Force, which has been mandated to begin using synthetic fuels to meet a portion of its energy needs. FEDCO Board President Steve Lundgren says, as working with the Air Force makes sense for the community.
This project has the potential to help us expand the military presence in Alaska and lessen the risk that our military bases might be closed or put on the BRAC list. That alone is reason enough to continue looking into this project. We know that the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. Air Force is interested in this project.
Eielson Air Force Base has received $10 million to study the potential of a switch to a coal-derived liquid fuel. A processing plant could be situated on base where there's demand for jet fuel, as well as byproduct steam for space heating and power generation. Bill Sakinger, an energy expert and FEDCO advisor, says the project could be upsized and meet energy needs beyond the interior.
We can see a situation where if we choose the plant size correctly, we could produce heating oil and diesel fuel for electric generation in all of the bush villages of Alaska and also the cities of Alaska, particularly those that are reachable by rail and also those that are reachable by sea.
Sakinger says fuel could even be exported. He says large coal-to-liquids plants operate successfully in South Africa and Qatar, and a number of facilities are being constructed in China. A key question that needs to be answered is how carbon dioxide produced by a plant in interior Alaska would be sequestered to avoid increasing the region's carbon footprint.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
The Alaska Board of Game has legalized trapping within 50 yards of many Juneau trails, as long as the traps are 5 feet off the ground and snow. As KTOO's John Ryan reports, the traps also have to be no more than 5 inches across.
The board's action reverses a 21-year-old ban on trapping within a quarter mile of 13 Juneau area trails. The list includes some of Juneau's most popular trails, like the Perseverance, Mount Roberts, and Dan Moeller trails. Cliff Judkins of Wasilla is the Board of Game's chair. He says the new regulation will increase trapping opportunities and maintain the safety of hikers, skiers, and their dogs.
No, it's not going to hurt anybody's dog. It's not even hurt a person with any injury. You stick their finger in one of those traps that they did have to get in, and they just learned not to do it again. You know, parks should have signs at their trailheads that says people trap in Alaska, and you may find traps in these areas. Watch your animals.
Hava Lee with the Gastineau Humane Society says she's concerned about the safety of dogs and people.
I think that 50 yards to a trail is too close. From my point of view as an executive director of the Humane Society, where we're not trying to make this an exercise between trapping and no trapping, but rather one that set trapping uniformly away from as many trails as possible.
A dog was killed in a trap within a few feet of the Eagle Glacier Trail this spring, and hikers and skiers have complained about traps near trails to the Juneau Area State Parks Citizen Advisory Board. The Parks Advisory Board wanted to increase the area off limits to trapping near Juneau trails. It proposed banning trapping within a quarter mile of 5 additional trails, including the Eagle Glacier and John Muir trails. The Game Board instead added the same 50-yard buffer to those trails. So now, trapping is allowed 50 yards away from 18 Juneau trails. Ryan Scott with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says 19 people set traps in the Juneau area last winter. He says it's hard to recruit new people to take up trapping with all the restrictions on the activity. The city and borough of Juneau prohibits traps and snares within a half mile of any public street. Game Board member Ben Grusendorf from Sitka says he's fearful of the consequences of the narrow buffer, given how many more hikers and skiers Juneau has than trappers.
For every trapper, there probably is 500 other users of that trail, even or more. I mean, these trails are really used in the wintertime, cross-country skiing and family outings.
Grusendorf was the only board member to vote for a 100-yard buffer instead of a 50-yard one.
The closer the trail you get, the more you're apt to have some youngster all bundled up trying to reach their hand up or into some little cubby hole to see what's in there. That might not be the best experiment either.
Game Board members say dog owners need to take more responsibility for their pets. Here's board member Lewis Bradley from Palmer.
I think that there's probably more people who get bit by dogs than there are people or dogs that get into traps.
The proposals to allow trapping as little as 50 yards from the 18 trails passed unanimously. Bigger traps, like the Conibear trap that killed Bubba the Basset Hound along the Eagle Glacier Trail last spring, are only allowed a quarter mile or farther from Juneau trails. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
The Game Board will focus on South Central and Southwest Alaska at its next meeting. It will be held in February in Anchorage. Students in a Western Alaska village, both young and old, have spent the past few months learning how to play the guitar. As KNOM's Laura Davis reports, it's part of a larger effort to encourage healthy lifestyles within a community that faces chronic challenges.
Alaska singer-songwriter Sarah Hansen recently traveled to the village of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island to teach a guitar workshop as the third part of a wellness program started by Gamble Citizens for Youth Wellness. The Gamble group, including several village members and the local physician's assistant, gathered in response to youth suicide attempts over the past few years. They wrote a grant to Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, a community development organization in Western Alaska, to buy 10 guitars, strings, and instructional DVDs, as well as provide travel for Hansen to teach. They hope to encourage emotional wellness through music. During her third trip to Gamble, Hansen reflected about her experiences teaching and her goals for the workshops.
I really hope that people who come to the lesson find a relationship with the music and will not only learn from what I'm teaching, but will explore it and always have that musical channel to bring energy to and feel positive feelings from having a relationship with music, which is something that I have. You know, although not all the kids have come back to the lessons who received guitars, I'm hoping that, you know, maybe someday they will pick it up again, or maybe their sister or their cousin or somebody will pick it up and discover that there's such a great resource for spiritual release and emotional release in music.
Hansen is gratified by the growth of the students in the program, including a young girl, Caitlin Cunahawk.
She is doing really well with it. The guitar is too big for her, but she just throws her little arm over it and reaches for the strings, and she's really progressing.
What made you want to play the guitar?
I saw a movie and it looked fun. My mom told me to join, and I said okay.
What did you think when you found out that Sarah was here giving away guitars?
I was excited.
What do you like about playing music?
Makes me feel happy when I'm sad.
There's a gentleman who's been coming, I guess he played 30 years ago and hadn't picked it up since, but just picked it up and just remembers everything, you know, how they say, just like riding a bike.
Rodney Unguluk is an elder in the village and enjoys the opportunity to share his passion for music with the youth in Gamble.
Do you think you'll be playing more regularly now that you've got a guitar?
Oh, yeah, especially with the young boys and girls that are practicing. I like to help them learn, too, because it's fun. Playing guitar is fun, and you get to play some songs, learn some songs. The fact that my two grandsons are practicing, too, and to me, that's good. So this tradition will go on in the family. When I play, like now, when I play, it's satisfying. It actually hits you in the heart, inside. Music makes me happy.
Sarah Hansen returns to Gamble for the last of the four workshops in November. Unguluk hopes the program will have a lasting influence on the youth in Gamble. In Nome, I'm Laura Davis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, John Ryan in Juneau, and Laura Davis in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.